Match Boy.
Overlooking Phoenix. From high above in the Star Worldwide Network Studios. Badge Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of the Badge Boys, the show where two retired cops talk to the community. I'm retired Crime Stopper Sergeant Darren Birch.
Retired Phoenix Police Detective Jason Schechterly.
And in honor of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, April, we have a wonderful guest who's going to share with us the courage to tell her story. Horrific accounts of sexual abuse, sexual assault, and I just can't wait to hear her talk. We have Audra Weeks with us. Then, the last segment, we have Stupid Suspect Stories, Unusual Twist. There's a coronavirus twist to it.
Uh-oh.
Then we have the heroic headlines and, of course, Jason's inspirational close. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you're going to be entertained.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Jason, I am so excited to have the opportunity, the honor to listen to our next guest. And you know how my career went in Phoenix Police.
Yes, sir.
30 years, about 15 years in investigations, 2 years in homicide, 2 years in assault, burglary, the bulk, 10 years in sex crimes.
And I know nothing means more to you.
It does. If there's a tombstone for your professional career, it would be rape detective. Yeah. So this month means a lot to me, April. I have a story in terms of people I know that have been raped. So when I hear someone telling their story, I can't help but be moved by their courage, because it's such a difficult thing to talk about. So personal, there's a million emotions that play. And so I cannot thank you enough, Audra, for being on our show. I'm talking to Audra Weeks, hypnotherapist, of all things. I can't wait to talk about that.
I was going to say, we're going to talk about that later, because I could use...
especially now.
I could use, right? Some of that, yeah.
With the corona stuff. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I don't want to just jump right into it. I'd love to hear a little bit about your upbringing, your background, who you are in terms of growing up, your local resident here in the Valley. Tell us about yourself.
Okay, so I'm Audra, and I am a native of Arizona.
You're the other one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Three of us here.
Yes.
Wow.
Thanks, guys.
That never happens.
I know it doesn't.
Wow, that's a hat
not
trick.
Anymore.
I know. Every summer, I'm like, why? Why do I?
Why do we stay?
Why am I here?
Especially in the summer.
Yeah, it's hot here. So a little bit about my background is I am a certified hypnotherapist, and I have a lot of certifications in energy work, specifically Reiki energy. Currently, I am a professional nanny, so I love to work with kids. About 3 years ago, I had noticed some patterns in my life, some repeating patterns, and I knew that there was something behind that. And so I went on a healing journey. I call it a healing journey. And I started going to therapy for that. And I started unburying trauma that I had in my past. I had a brother that committed suicide when I was very young. And then I had a stepdad verbally tell me that he desired to molest me. He had a desire to molest me.
And that's sexual abuse.
Yes, it is. And then later, we turned full circle, and he attempted to. He attacked me, and his intent behind it was to molest me. So, and then a little bit later after that, when I was in high school, this happened when I was in high school too with my stepdad, but A little further down the line, I was raped when I was 17. And then a little bit further down the line from that, I was a victim of attempted murder. So I had a family member that had come into my aunt's house in the middle of the night and started with me because I was the only one downstairs. But his intent was to beat me to death in my sleep.
I want to kind of go back, if you don't mind, and talk about your childhood in terms of the stepfather and that sexual abuse. A lot of people don't realize that telling someone, soliciting, grooming, these are all a crime in terms of trying to solicit a minor for sexual, you know, activity, exploitation of a minor, depending on what state, depends on what crime it's called. A lot of people don't realize how insidious of a crime that is because they are betraying that trust that you have in them as an adult. They're betraying that love that you have for them. Your own emotions betray yourself in terms of how you feel about them, because many times we can't help but love our abuser because we have that bond, that connection. Can you talk a little bit about what occurred and some of the things I've talked about? Am I close? Am I right? Am I way off?
No, you're nailing it. It's true. I had a lot of the struggle with my stepdad was, it's kind of hard to put into words because, like you said, I knew there was something wrong with what he was doing and what he was telling me, but yet I still loved him. And so it was very confusing to me as a young teenager, what was love supposed to look like? And for intimacy, that kind of intimacy with someone who's inappropriate was hard for me. So I had a lot of confusion growing up and dating. And even still now, I think that there's some core beliefs that come to play as far as intimacy goes, because that's a very confusing situation. Here you have someone who's supposed to be your father figure telling you that he thinks of you when he is having sex with your mom. So
how old were you when that was the first started?
I was 13 or 14. I don't
puberty.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to start high school. And, you know, I hadn't had any experience prior. I think maybe I had kissed a boy, and I, of course, had crushes on boys, but that was my first experience beyond, you know, your childhood.
Teen beat.
Yeah. And we were sitting out on the porch and having a conversation, and when he was talking to me, I saw his penis coming out of his shorts. He was getting aroused by sitting with me, talking to me. And I tried to pretend like I didn't see it, but he knew that I had saw. And so then he started talking to me about how he felt about me and, you know, the thoughts that he had about me, that he thought about me when he was in the shower, having sex with my mom. And I didn't know what to do with that at all. So I just got up and went into the house and went into a room where one of my brothers was because I needed to feel safe. At that point, I didn't feel safe. I struggled to tell my mom about that because back in that day, I don't know if you remember the after school specials.
I do. ABC after school specials.
Yeah, but a lot of them had to do with like molestation.
Yes, absolutely, they did.
And when the child went to go tell the parent didn't believe them. And so I was afraid that that was going to be my story, that I was going to go tell my mom and she wasn't going to believe me. So I had a hard time telling her. I confided in one of my best friends, and her mom told me that I had to tell my mom, and she said that she would do it with me, that I didn't have to do it alone.
How beautiful.
Yep. So she, sat with me and held space for me and supported me as I told my mom, and my mom believed me. I think that it helped her to receive the information, because when she had told my stepdad that my best friend's mom had reached out to her and had something important she needed to talk to her about, I think my stepdad knew what it was and he told her.
Let me ask you this. At this point, how long had he been your stepfather? How long was he in that role as a father figure? And how long did it stop? Did he continue in that role? Can you talk a little bit about that?
He hadn't been in the role as my stepfather for very long. It was probably a year or two that he was in the house. And he did. So my mom and him decided that they were going to go to counseling together and she was going to stay with him. And she would check in with me and ask me if I was doing okay with it. And I would tell her that I was, but I wasn't.
You're helping your mom, not helping yourself.
Right. I felt like, I think one, I wanted to be okay with it because it was awful. It was awful living under the same roof with someone knowing that that's what they thought about you. Like anytime he would walk by my room to the bathroom to take a shower, I would feel sick to my stomach. Like, is he going to think about me when he's in there? It was awful. I didn't feel safe in my home anymore.
Did you ever think that the reason he connected with your mother, married your mother, could have been going after you, like kind of like the Lolita aspect?
I've never had that thought. I know that later I had found out, this was years later, I had found out that my mom, when all this came out, she found out that he had molested his daughter. And so when he went to go marry her, rather than his family telling her, hey, this is in his past or in his background, or even him owning it, they just let it happen knowing that she had a teenage daughter. I basically got thrown to the wolf.
Yeah, you did.
And so she was really upset to find that out. Like, had someone told her, she probably would have made a different decision in marrying him. But she did stay with him, and they did counseling, and I just pretty much stayed away from him.
Yeah, a lot of these predators will absolutely look for a victim through a marriage. We've had grandparents, you know, grandfathers marry into a family with young children and so forth. Talk a little bit, if you can, about the escalation, how you didn't feel safe, and how many days, weeks, years continued into this cycle.
So we were living in the same house for about a year and a half after this. I just pretty much avoided him at all costs. I refused to be in the same room with him. His kids would come over, and it was hard to have a relationship with them. I don't think they liked me because they saw me being kind of mean towards their dad or very detached. And I don't think that they realized the weight that obviously they didn't realize the weight that I was carrying and why I acted like that. But I think they thought I was just kind of like a spoiled brat.
Would even the daughter that he molested still come visit?
She came around very rarely. So she was driving when him and my mom got married. So she wasn't around a whole lot. But my mom never found, you know, suspicion in that, because that's common for a teenager that's driving. They don't really hang out with the family anymore. Right. They're kind of doing their own thing.
And that was a secret until recently, if you will.
Yeah, it was.
Relatively speaking.
Yeah, I would say about three years after everything went down, like the completion of it, my mom and my stepdad getting divorced, when we talked about it later, it wasn't too long after that. I was still in high school when I found out that he had molested his daughter too. And I had to go through a forgiveness process with my mom. Like, how could you, if you found that out, how could you stay with him knowing that he had already verbally, you know, expressed his desire to want to molest me? How could you stay with that?
When you talked about the divorce, was that in conjunction with his attempt?
It was. So when they decided to go to counseling, she told me if he ever tried anything like this again, it would be done and over with. No ands, ifs, or buts. And she, about 2.5 years later, going back a little further, about a year and a half after he expressed his desire, they were building a house out in New River. So they were out there quite a bit. And in order to continue building that house, they had to sell the house in Phoenix. So they sold the house in Phoenix. I finished out my sophomore year of high school with a girlfriend. I lived with her and her mom. And so that was a huge reprieve for me, a break from living under the same roof with him.
Feeling unsafe day to day.
Mm-hmm. So then after my sophomore year, I moved out to New River with them. And it kind of like time had passed and nothing had happened. So it seemed like everyone just kind of forgot about it, like it was not going to happen again. Or I still had a very disconnected relationship with him, but enough time had passed and I had gotten a break from him.
Felt safe.
I felt somewhat safe, and I was trying to rebuild a relationship with him. And then my mom, she was in Mexico one weekend, and I woke up and he was standing over me and he was drunk. I could smell the alcohol on his breath, and I knew that I was in a very bad situation. And I told, you know, I asked him to get out of my room and he wouldn't get out of my room. And then I got, you know, it got a little heated and I was basically yelling at him to get out of my room and he wouldn't. He said, I'm lonely. I miss your mom. I miss my son, because his son was visiting his mom in Phoenix. And I said, okay, well, just let me wake up and I'll come out and I'll sit with you and talk to you. And as soon as he left my room, I locked my doors and I got myself together.
You had a plan.
Yes. And then I tried to sneak out to my car, but he was out there waiting for me. So what happened then was he physically attacked me because he didn't want me to leave. So he physically attacked me and I was able to get away from him. I had on a jacket and he had grabbed the sleeve of my jacket while I slipped out of the jacket and ran to my car and got in and locked the door. Then he stood behind my car and was refusing to let me leave. And I started backing up. I didn't care.
Good for you.
If I needed to run him over to get out of there, that's what was going to happen.
Good for you.
So he got out of the way. And then my mom came home a couple days later. I stayed with a friend until I knew she was home. And then she came home and I told her what had happened. And that was it. And there was a huge blowout. He got violent. He had a shotgun like on the porch, refusing to let my mom come into the house. It was,
wow.
It was a nightmare.
How are you today with just that aspect of trauma in terms of what you've done for healing, talking about it? Talk a little bit about that, where you are today.
So when I recently went on this healing journey, that, of course, was one of the things that I talked about and started working through. I think that I'm doing pretty good as far as that particular event. I think that having a dialogue with my mom afterwards and growing up and maturing and being able to see it from an adult perspective rather than a child has helped me to understand how my mom stayed with him. And it's also helped me that going through the therapy has helped me find forgiveness in my mom and my stepdad for all of it happening.
Yeah, because that helps you. It's not for their benefit. I should say him. To me, he's the monster. He was a predator. His paraphilic nature, his desire. You know, this was someone who groomed. He picked, in my thoughts, he picked that relationship with your mom so he could get to you for him to stay there and keep grooming and these sort of things. And so when you talk about forgiveness, talk about that, how that helps you as far as the anger and coming to a peace.
So I think with my background and my education, when I was going to college, I was majoring in psychology and minoring in criminal law. I think learning different aspects of people, of human nature, it gave me an understanding that there's something wrong with him. So he probably wasn't just born and decided he was going to be
a pedophile.
Something must have happened somewhere in his life that caused him to do something like that.
Or bad wiring.
Yes, because I don't believe that. I believe good people most of the time make good choices, barring some mistakes that we all have being humans, learning, growing. But in essence, you know, good people make good choices healthy people make good choices, and people that are sick or wounded inside tend to make unhealthy choices, whether it be to themselves or to somebody else. So knowing that, and then going through school for hypnotherapy, I learned a lot about the subconscious mind, and then going through therapy myself, I think that I have that awareness that there had to be something wrong with him. There was something wrong.
He's broken.
Yes. And so that helped me to find forgiveness for him. Because this is probably, I don't know if this might sound weird to you as someone who's been involved, you know, studying it. And
the cop aspect.
Yes. He was a good person. He was a good, kind-hearted person. And that is one of the things that was really hard for me when it was all happening, because I liked him. He liked spending time with me. He liked listening to me. And that was something that I didn't get a whole lot of from my biological father. He wasn't around a lot. So to have a male figure, father figure, want to invest in me and spend time with me, that meant a lot to me. And he did betray me. He betrayed our relationship by wanting to molest
me. Yeah. Even Michael Jackson's victims loved him.
Yes. And I see that when I see other stories like that, I can see myself and I understand, because there's parts of me that say, what is wrong with me?
Bless your heart.
You know, like, why would I, how could you?
What did I do?
Yes. How? What did I do? And
you just being a kid.
Yeah. And I think that as an adult, learning all the things that I've learned, I know that there was something
wrong with him.
Yes. There was something wrong with him. So I can forgive him. And I also see like my mom's background and how she was brought up, and you know, she wanted to forgive him too. And so she agreed with the counseling, like everybody deserves a second chance type thing. And I think had I been honest with her about how it was affecting me and that
day-to-day fear.
Yes. But I wasn't honest with her. And all she had was what I was telling her. She only had to go on what I said.
Since the divorce, is that the last time you've seen or spoken to him?
I have never seen him again.
And how did he treat how many biological brothers do you have?
All my siblings are half, but at that time, I'm the youngest of all my siblings. And so it was myself and his stepson that lived with my mom and him.
And he's the one that you went to his room for safety, that brother?
No. So when I was still living in Phoenix, one of my half-brothers still lived with us. And that's the brother that I went into the room with. So when we moved out to New River, all of my other half-brothers were out of the house.
And how did he, all these years later, I'm sure conversations, recollections, things have come up. How did he treat the boys? Were you were truly just singled out?
I was singled out.
By him?
Yeah, and I think that my brother that was still in the house was old enough to where he was completely like independent, doing his own thing, working. So he wasn't around a whole lot.
But he didn't even suffer verbal abuse or any, I mean, it was strictly dedicated toward you.
Yes. And he wasn't verbally abusive. Like he wasn't a mean human being.
Sexually abusive, sexually suggestive.
Yes.
But when he used the term, when he told you what he wanted to do with you, he actually used the word molest.
He did not use that word.
Okay. I'm sorry.
He just talked about what he wanted to do.
Yes. Okay.
Talking aloud, if you will,
yeah.
In the sexual nature and sexual vein.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's very common. It's referred to as grooming. Saying it out loud makes it less of a taboo. He's, I hate to use the word typical predator, but he really is. I'm listening to what you have to say. And I can't wait to hear more about your journey because you're doing really great now. So after this station break, we'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
I'll never forget.
Never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
My first call up ever as a member of the National Guard.
When we got to the armory, they briefed us on the wildfires. They were getting dangerously close to homes.
Helicopters were going out to drop water on the fires.
Guys in the unit were preparing for firefighting with local fire crews.
At that moment, I got my first taste of just how important the Guard is to my community.
See how the Guard can be an important part of your life at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Batch Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Batch Boys.
Welcome back to Batch Boys, everybody. And we are back with Audra. Thank you for that first segment. I am humbled and moved by your strength and your ability to talk about this. And as we move past that initial part, you mentioned when we first started that you started going through therapy and it was bringing things up for you that you had you hidden them, put them away? And is that why you do what you do now in your own hypnotherapist? Do you focus on getting people to bring to the surface things that they might not realize? They know something's affecting their life, but they don't know why. Is that how your journey came to be?
What's interesting about the hypnotherapy journey for me was, so I think I did, as a child, I did learn to bury the hard stuff. So when my brother committed suicide, our family didn't deal with that. It was basically swept under the carpet and we moved on and pretended like it never happened. And we didn't talk about it because it was too hard for my mom. So when I was, that happened when I was 9. So I learned that when the hard stuff comes up and it's too hard, you sweep it under the carpet, you bury it. So I had buried all these things. And I think that's one of the reasons why I had a struggle in being honest with my mom about what, you know, how I felt, truly how I felt about what was happening with my stepdad, about not feeling safe in the house and not being okay with it. I felt part of it was I needed to not make it harder for her. I needed to protect her. And from what I learned from my brother's suicide, it kind of carried over into this. And I also didn't want to deal with it. I didn't know how to handle my feelings. They were too big for me. I didn't understand them. I didn't know how to process the fact that my father figure was fantasizing about me sexually. I did not know how to process that. So I found myself later in life, it's almost like it's happening on a subconscious level, but I started going to school. In college, I was studying criminology and psychology. And my reasoning behind that was when my uncle had tried to murder me, I wanted to understand how someone could do something like that. I wanted to understand that mind, like how, what brings them to a place where they can murder somebody that they know. And so I went to school to study this and I wanted to help other people. I wanted to be a forensic psychologist. So I ended up not finishing school for that. But then later in life, I found myself in hypnotherapy school. It's almost like subconsciously I knew that I had all these wounds that needed to be healed, things that hadn't been dealt with, things that hadn't been processed through. And I was subconsciously telling myself that I needed to heal. But consciously, I'm like, I want to go do these things because I want to help other people heal. But it was really me that so desperately wanted to heal. I just didn't realize it because I had buried everything so deeply. And then when I started therapy initially because I started recognizing patterns that was happening in my life. And I'm like, something greater is at play here. And I need to figure out what that is. Or otherwise, I'm just going to keep repeating these patterns. I knew enough about the subconscious mind going to school for hypnotherapy that there was something much deeper at play. That's when you start seeing the patterning. People pattern with their subconscious beliefs. And I was seeing a pattern.
Like self-harming patterns?
Yeah, like when I was dating, after I got divorced, I was dating men that could not show up for me. And, you know, like I would chase after these men. Like I so desperately wanted them to pick me and choose me and love me. And I think that, you know, the issues that I had around abandonment with my biological father and then the misunderstanding about what love is supposed to look like from the opposite sex because of my stepdad, I just was very confused. And so I realized, I was smart enough to know this isn't right for me to chase after somebody that is not a very nice person. Like these men weren't very nice to me. And it's like, why am I chasing these people? So I decided that I was going to find a therapist and start the counseling. And I started cognitive therapy is what I chose to do. So I did cognitive reframing and I went through all the traumas that I had experienced in my life and uncovered the core beliefs that were creating the patterns that I had in my life.
Can we talk about some of those other traumas in terms of the sexual assault? You mentioned that this was after the father figure, I'll call him the predator monster, was out of your life. Can you tell us about what happened in regards to this sexual assault?
Sure. So after my mom divorced my stepdad, I kind of went off the deep end as far as experimenting with drugs and alcohol and stuff. I was struggling internally with, even though my stepdad was out of the picture, I had a lot of blame on myself about what my mom was going through. Like, I felt it was my fault that she was going through a divorce, that she was losing another husband. So I blamed myself a lot, and I did a lot of self-harming. I was drinking a lot of alcohol, weekend parties out in the desert. I was experimenting with some heavier drugs. And one weekend, I was at a huge desert party. It was huge. It was a big, huge event that happened out in New River. And there was hundreds of people there. And I had way too much to drink that night. I'm still in high school. Had way too much to drink that night. And I went and passed out in, I think, my friend's car. I say that I found my friend's car and I passed out in it, but in all honesty, I don't know whose car it was. So I got in the back seat and I passed out, and I came in and out of consciousness to a kid that I went to school with on top of me raping me. And I was so intoxicated that I had no control over my body. There was no way I could get him off of me. I couldn't even stay conscious. Like, I was going in and out of consciousness while it was happening. And I never told anybody that that happened to me up until about 5 years ago. I finally spoke it out of my body. And it was, I had buried that so deeply that when I said it out loud to one of my friends, I didn't even recognize my own voice. Like, who said that? That's how I felt. Who said that? Where did that come from? And I realized I finally said it. In that moment, I remember I felt so much shame, but at the same time, I felt so much relief that I had finally said it out loud. And
empowerment?
Yes. And I felt like I unloaded a bag of bricks by saying it out loud. Like, I no longer had to carry that by myself because I had finally found the courage to say it out loud.
Did you, throwing that therapy, did they ever talk about writing, you know, your thoughts and writing it down, cathartic journey and words and so forth? They ever talk about that? And have you ever thought about writing a book?
So in cognitive reframing, part of it is you write out the trauma in as much detail as you can. And I did. And then during the following 12 weeks, you are supposed to read these traumas every day, and it's supposed to help you kind of lose the impact of the emotions around it. It helps you work through. You're not as...
it's workable.
Yes. There's a charge. It helps you to work through that charge. The charge is supposed to lessen the more you read it. So I did do that. And then after I finished the cognitive therapy, I'm still in therapy to this day, I decided that I was going to write a book about all of it, about all the traumas, about the healing journey, about cognitive therapy, about the subconscious mind. And so that book is currently, it's completed and it's in the editing process, and I'm working with a publisher, and so far everything is on track for that book to be in print at the end of the summer this year.
Do you have a working title? Do you have a set title? And also the publisher's name, in case someone's listening, they want to pick up that book. It may very well be available by the time they're listening to this show.
Yep. So the title of the book is called Moving Mountains, A Hero's Journey. My publisher is Becky Norwood from Spotlight Publishing, and it will be available on Amazon. And if you are listening and it's summer, you can find me social media, Audra Renee Weeks on Facebook and Audra Renee Weeks on Instagram. And hopefully I will be getting a website, a landing page soon.
Was there any conversation between you and the culprit? And because that is absolutely 100% sexual assault. You're incapacitated. That's non-consensual. Any kind of contact afterwards? Was there an awkwardness? Did he try to intimidate you? Or was, can you talk a little bit about that?
There was no contact with him after that. I saw him at school and I did what I always did. I avoided. If I crossed paths with him, I would put my head down like I had something to be ashamed about. I don't even know if he remembers. I know how drunk I was. I remember it. I'll never forget it, but I don't know. He never approached me about it. He never said anything. I never said anything.
Do you think, because what happened with your stepfather and your mother's, I don't want to use the word acceptance, but looking the other way for therapy. You think that stopped you from reporting that incident? Did you know at the time this is absolutely a rape? I should call the police. Can you talk a little bit about that? And now, looking back, what kind of advice would you give to a girl that may be listening to this show and fighting with those type of that kind of pain and not talking about it?
I think logically, I knew that it was, I knew that I had been raped. And I also knew that I should probably report it, but I didn't. In my mind, all I could think about was, if I tell anybody that this happened, they're going to say that it's your fault because you were doing something that you were not supposed to be doing. You were out drinking alcohol. You put yourself in a position. This is what you get. And that is, like, in my heart, that is how I felt. Logically, I knew it was rape, but my core beliefs and my where I was at emotionally and mentally, I blamed myself.
And sadly, that's all too common with young girls. It's the what were you wearing syndrome.
Can
you
know, I say something, Darren?
Please.
Her and I have a lot in common. That's why we're soul sisters, because at 17, I was drugged and raped as well. And I'm the other end of the spectrum. I went home and I told my parents and they did nothing. And my advice to girls out there is, if someone does nothing, go to somebody else. Keep going till you find somebody that listens, because this is a hard thing to live with. You do get blamed. My father looked at me and said, well, were you drinking? I said, I had two sips of a beer and I woke up on a weight bench being raped by a big guy. He goes, well, you shouldn't have been drinking beer. You're only 17. That's what I got. And that was hard. That was very difficult to have no support system at home with both my parents being right there. My mom has no recall today of that even happening. Wow. So you've got to go to whoever. It doesn't matter. Tell your friends. Keep going until somebody listens to you.
Kind of like your friend, Audra, her mom listening and saying, no, we're going to tell your mom. And I think that's the power of the shows like this. And when you talk about it, it gives women out there, young girls, that knowledge, that power base, empowering them. So I applaud both of you for talking about this. Looking back, Audra, in terms of both these horrific events, can you encapsulate them in terms of the betrayal? One was a father, one was a school friend, one you're young and truly vulnerable in this home, and the other one, you're intoxicated, pass out, vulnerable based on the intoxicant. Can you talk about that betrayal?
Back at that time, I didn't really recognize it as a betrayal because I didn't allow myself to process what was actually happening. After I was raped, I felt ashamed. I felt like it was my fault. So I didn't look at him as he betrayed me. I looked at myself like, this is all your own fault. You did this to yourself. You shouldn't have been drinking. This is what you get. So after that happened, I stopped drinking. You know, I stopped doing things that were going to put me in a position to where I did not have control over my body. I started using heavier drugs like crystal meth. Like, I started using speed, where I still had control over my body and I knew what was going on around me, but I still couldn't handle my reality and I needed some way to escape it. So I don't really...
At the time, you didn't look at it as betrayal.
No.
Yeah. But now?
I try to be optimistic and look on the bright side, and there's nothing I can do to take back what has happened to me. And so moving forward, I say that this is what's happened to me, and now I have an opportunity to take what has happened and possibly help somebody else through what they're going through, letting them know that it's not their fault. And my advice to other people out there that are afraid to tell, my advice would be to tell too. And just like Robin said, keep telling until someone listens to you. Mm-hmm. And carrying that weight of being raped for 26 years all by myself was very damaging to myself. I still have a lot to work through around that particular trauma. And I think it's because that particular trauma was buried. I mean, like, all the other traumas, like with my stepdad and with my uncle and my brother, like, there were so many other people involved that it wasn't a secret. But when I got raped, it was a secret. It was a secret that I kept inside of myself. And secrets like that are poison.
Time bomb.
Yes, they are a time bomb. And so it's, this particular trauma is the hardest for me to talk about because I know that, you know, I still have a lot of emotions around it. Powerlessness, feeling powerless when I was in the backseat of that car, over my feelings now. So the last couple of days I've had a lot of anxiety knowing I was going to do this podcast and it was going to be topic specific. Like there was going to be no room for me to, nowhere for me to hide basically. And I realized even though I had anxiety about it and I was scared, like how am I going to feel when I'm talking about this on the air? What if I start crying? What if emotions start coming out? How am I going to feel afterwards? What am I going to go through? Because I know when I wrote this chapter in the book, I had a really hard time recovering. And 3 months after I'd written the chapter, I was still trying to pick myself up off the floor after writing about so in depth about being raped. I ended up having to go on an antidepressant to help me get through. And I went on that for like 4 or 5 months to help me kind of take the edge off and get through it. But now, in the last couple of days, I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I need to walk through this fear and talk about it, because if I cannot walk through that fear and talk about it, then that event is still robbing me of my life. It's taking my freedom away from me, and I refuse.
Good for you.
I refuse.
Good for you.
I'm so proud of you.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Just so proud, and I cannot thank you enough for sharing something so intimate, sad, painful. As Jason always talks about, the vulnerability can truly help us in terms of getting it out. And how do you feel now?
I feel good. I feel empowered. And, you know, like talking about it and speaking it out loud and it is very empowering, because for so long it robbed me of a lot of my life, and not anymore.
And in closing, unless you have anything, Jason?
No, I'm just
stunned.
I am. I'm stunned. I'm so impressed with your strength. I'm appreciative of how many people you're going to help. But you covered all the bases. You used drugs and alcohol, which a lot of people do. But you still went through the process of learning, educating yourself, identifying not only your own problems, but just being educated on a broader scale to make your life better in the future. And to have that entire spectrum covered, because usually people only, they either bury it forever and force themselves to move on, or they do get lost in self-medicating and hiding and never bringing it back to the surface. You seem to have come full circle. And I know you said you still have a lot of things to work through. I have no idea how you feel today about intimacy, or if you've ever found the love that you understand
and deserve,
how it's supposed to be. But what you've covered today is it truly is, it blows my mind. And I am deeply appreciative that you've done that. I'm glad to hear that I'm sorry that you felt anxiety leading up to this today, but now that you've sat here and it's truly off your chest, we're here, it's over, we're coming to a close. And for you to say that you now feel empowered and the anxiety, I guess, has lessened, that's a testament to why we're all doing what we're doing.
We're so here for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And one last time, the book. Tell us about that title, the publisher, and it'll be on Amazon probably in the summer of 2020.
Yep, the end of summer 2020, it'll be on Amazon, and it's called Moving Mountains, A Hero's Journey, and the publisher is Spotlight Publishing.
And we'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
You know, Jason, I am so impressed with our last guest. Not just that she had the courage and the vulnerability, but the fact that she had anxiety to do our show and still came in and did it. And what a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yeah, and she did it with grace.
Oh,
my gosh.
She did
it with strength, and I'm
I can't wait for the book to come out.
I'm kind of at a loss for words. It was awesome.
I genuinely cannot wait for that book to come out. I really can't.
It's a really good read, Darren.
Oh.
It is.
Oh, see, I'm jealous. You've read it.
Well, yeah.
Oh.
She's a friend of mine. Of course I read it.
Good for you. Oh, I can't wait.
It's an amazing story. It is gut-wrenching. It's hard to get through some of it, but it is a very, very beautiful, well-rounded story.
And for there to be so much pain, anxiety, difficult, that's almost the ingredients of heroism.
Yes.
Truly. And so that's my segue to you, Jason. That's going to be hard to top for your heroic headline, but I know you can do it. I know
yeah,
you can do it, my friend.
As you know, right now throughout the country, there are countless heroic headlines going on from first responders, those on the front lines, people right down to, I saw a headline this morning that federal and state governments are trying to get grocery store workers listed as frontline employees, first responders, and they should be. I think
they're on the front line.
Yes,
they are.
And
it's a new reality.
They are so needed. So This week's, I'm taking just one small snippet of something that's happened across the country. Unfortunately, this does not have a happy or successful ending, but I think it needs to be brought to people's attention. Many of you might know that on Easter Sunday, some tornadoes tore through the South all the way up through the Carolinas, and there was a story out of Lawrence County, Mississippi. 18 counties were affected by the tornadoes on Easter Sunday, with current fatalities so far at 11. And of those lost was a Lawrence County Sheriff's deputy and his wife. According to the release by the Sheriff's Office, the deputy had shielded his wife from the storm as it raged through their home. And the aftermath of the tornado, with winds in excess of 150 miles an hour, left homes completely torn to shreds. Authorities are still working through the affected areas and understanding the total casualties. But Deputy Robert Ainsworth and his wife Paula were among those identified having been killed by the storm. And it was shown and proven that his last act as a first responder, his last act of heroism as a husband, he tried to shield her. Unfortunately, they both lost their lives. So even though we're all going through this corona thing and all bitching and moaning because we're stuck at home and we're all dealing with our own stuff, you still have Mother Nature who will prop up once in a while and say, you know what, I got something for you too. And God bless him, the rest of his family, and everybody that just what you're going through right now. It's every day it's something new.
It really is. I as sad as that is, I just love the idea that this first responder, this police officer, his last act on this planet was trying to protect his wife. It's a beautiful sentiment.
And if you can take anything wonderful, it's the fact that they are together, even in the afterlife.
Gosh,
I know
brutal
that's hard,
times.
But it's just, you know.
You know, I'm looking at these brutal times, the coronavirus, people losing their jobs, their businesses. There's so much tragedy that, with the stupid suspect story, I wanted to kind of do something different.
Uh-oh.
I wanted to kind of take a lighthearted look at some of these headlines. There is a business out there that is being devastated by the social distancing, and that is, there's nothing more awkward than getting a lap dance at a strip club 6 feet away.
God.
There is the strip club like industry is in peril. They really are. These poor young ladies are working their fingers to the bone, trying to help.
So it's not a lap dance, first of all.
Well, it's a difficult lap dance. Yes.
That is not a lap dance. If you're 6 feet away and not on the lap, it's not a lap dance.
And now some of the headlines I'm seeing is now they are asking, the strip club industry is asking for help with the business they're losing, which is the stimulus package. So, yes, they're
stimulate
looking for
you
stimulus.
In a different way.
Yes, they've helped us with our stimulus package for so many years. Now it's our time to help them. This was from CNN. Strip club wants stimulus help. Yes, CNN, so take it with a grain of salt. Strip clubs are suing the federal government to get access to coronavirus stimulus dollars. The owners of Little Darling Strip Club in Flint, Michigan, and Silk Exotic Gentlemen's Club in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, brought lawsuits over the past few days against the U.S. Small Business Administration because the businesses applied but are not given stimulus relief. Again, I love the headline. I think it's kind of funny. So maybe we can have fun with it for a little bit.
Stimulating relief.
Yes,
Darren,
yes.
And we're talking about strip clubs here. Darren is covering.
Oh, my God.
Again, these women work to the bone. Okay.
Oh.
Okay. The next headline is,
dude,
dancing may be dirty, but New York strip clubs are keeping it clean during the coronavirus outbreak. Flash Dancers in New York City, which has locations in Times Square and Tribeca, is conducting, quote, thorough deep cleanse twice a day between each shift. The manager named Bob K, who declined to give his last name, and that's something I keep seeing in this. All these managers don't want to give their last names.
Gee, I wonder why.
I don't blame them at all.
He said, and again, Bob said, strippers, quote, are also wearing face masks, saying that this is not a joking matter. So, yeah, but staffers say the buck-tucking biz hasn't been hurt by the coronavirus, which had at least 167 confirmed cases in New York on Tuesday afternoon. So there's a lot of things going on in this business. Quote, our business has actually spiked due to more locals coming out and less tourists in the neighborhood, says Bob, without a last name, adding that the Jiggle Joint has plenty of hand sanitizer available for their customers. Yeah, he said that. Hand sanitizers.
At the Jiggle Joint. Has hand sanitizer.
Hand sanitizer. And he did not call it hand cream. I'm just going to put that out there. No, he didn't. He didn't. Okay, the next headline is Larry Flint's Hustler Club. Coronavirus. Coronavirus won't shut us down if you follow these instructions. So Larry Flint is helping us stay safe during these difficult times
really?
In a strip club. Yeah, apparently. The Vegas
I didn't even know he was still alive.
Apparently
I'm not
he
kidding
is.
You.
I know. I didn't know either. But the Vegas strip joint might seem like a potential coronavirus hot zone. It's got tourists from around the globe. There's cash, which is notorious for spreading filth. They're dirty, the cash. And there's that up close course contact with the lap dance, but the hustler is taking extreme precautions. He has a PSA to remind patrons about the best coronavirus defense, which is simply washing hands. Hustler's hammering home the point with assistance from the dancers who are creating this PSA. And Larry Flint hired a professional custodian company called Super Janitors to help them, go home. Oh, to help them clean throughout the night. Sorry about that. You'll probably go home, you know, broke because you're not going to have any money, but, and you'll probably have glitter all over you, but you're going to have clean hands now. So thank you, Larry Flint.
Wait a minute. Do they sterilize the stripper pole between each girl?
But they clean hands. They're washing hands. Yes.
But other body parts touch the pole.
All I have to say in closing at these strip joints are between a rock and a hard place now.
Oh, Lord.
No, it's true. It's true.
Robin, I don't know how you have a law enforcement podcast that eventually comes to the point where one of the hosts, not me.
It's got to be me.
Is thanking Larry Flint. It's going to take me until next week's show to process.
I'm going to say this just as a woman. There are many of you guys, whether you're in law enforcement or not, at one time or another have thanked Larry Flint for publishing a magazine.
Yes, but I was 14 or 15 all we had. I didn't have it I didn't have it on my cell phone back then. I had to actually steal a magazine. So, yes, I did thank him 30-something years ago.
See, there you go.
It's a public service. We're here to help everyone.
That was 35 years ago.
We're here to help everyone.
Not today.
It was still part of your childhood.
That's incredibly true.
See, based on my, I took us to a lap dance, which is the almost the bowels of depravity and humanity.
Not a lap dance. Quit calling it that. It was 6 feet away.
Do you know from experience? I just had to say that. I do know
what a lap dance is, and I know I know what the definition.
I've read about them.
Okay,
we need something inspirational, my friend.
Jason's looking at me like he's going to kill me.
Don't mind the dead air, everybody. Just give me 5 seconds to collect my thoughts and get away from Darren and his topic.
We all know that cops have a weird sense of humor. Come on.
It's wicked. Cop humor is the best, and we would be lost without it. A lot of people wouldn't understand it, but you.
Thanks to you two guys, now I have a bunch of cop friends. I'm learning that.
This week, you guys know that I am incredibly passionate about just simply every day, one goal, one mission, leave the day better than you found it. And right now it's a little difficult. We can all do our part with keeping ourselves safe, not breaking quarantine rules, keeping other people safe. It's very difficult right now though, because we're all separated and we are for the most part quiet at home. And I got a great dose of inspiration on Sunday this week. Every week, I FaceTime with my lovely daughter who lives in Texas and is married and finishing up grad school. And thank God for technology and FaceTime that I get to see her beautiful face. But this week on Sunday, you know, obviously they're bored and miserable just like the rest of us. Her school is shut down and her husband, my son-in-law Brian, is a teacher, a football coach, a basketball coach, baseball coach. Everything has been taken away from him for right now. And when I asked him what he was doing, you know, just, hey, how are things going? He was so excited to tell me he had taken the Amazon gift card that we got him for Christmas. He bought a 3D printer, which I've heard of these things, but I didn't really know what they were capable of. And he is spending his time, his own money, buying the materials, and he is making masks for nurses and hospitals. And it takes one full day to just simply make two of these masks. But then he showed them to me. They are incredible and they are going to save lives. And this is what he's doing every day is he starts this 3D printer and he makes these masks and he's giving them away free of charge. And I was just so inspired by that. And this was 3 days ago, and I'm still feeling it. And so I wanted to give my son-in-law a shout-out because you are leaving the day and the world better than you found it, and all of us need to do that in whatever way we can. So God bless all of you. We will be back next Wednesday, and I can't wait because it gets me out of the house. So thank you, Robin. Thank you to our guest, Darren, again.
Love you, brother.
Bringing in our guest, Audra. I will never forget her. That was just incredible, and I love you too. God bless all of you. We'll see you next week.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide Networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.